summer. The arrival of spring is always surprising. Its abruptness is breathtaking. One day the soil is frozen and unyielding, and the next day the broccoli is going to seed. In contrast, the only way to notice the arrival of summer is to notice that everything attains its full potential. The canopy of trees have filled in. There is an abundance of eggs to collect in the chicken coop. For me, the fullness of summer declares itself in the studio, when I can spend uninterrupted days and nights torturing myself in endless attempts to understand where I am going to with my work. Producing the current body of work is testing, a slow process of inspirations and reservations. The mood and nature. Both have been exhausted as subjects of artistic endeavour. I'm not that vain to believe that my way of painting women's form or the landscape will be an earth-shattering contribution to the world of art. Yet I continue to toil. Faith keeps me going. Faith that one day I will understand the whys, that one day it will all make sense. By definition, faith is an act of the imagination that allows us to accept that which cannot be proven. And my imagination is working overtime creating assurances. The local farmers call my studio the shed. For me, the 200 square metres framed by ironbark posts and corrugated iron is a sanctuary in which I dare to question or be idle. The solid structure and the green acres that surround it protect me from the world's insanity. Here, like a farmer who reshapes the soil, I create realities of sorts on stretched linen. In the studio, I am free to merge space and form, diffuse time and the figure, to create without limitations. I consider myself extremely fortunate to be able to work with some sort of wilderness around me, even though the studio's windows can present alluring disruptions. In the spring, a wagtail built her nest in the apple tree. I was busy at the easel when my eyes caught a slight movement outside. A bird was hovering, holding a piece of straw in the tip of her beak, until she carefully placed it in the half-built nest on a solid branch. She flew away, and several minutes later she was back with some white stuff that might have been a spiderweb. For a long time she returned again and again with assortments of fine straw, spiderweb, bark and tiny twigs. When she was satisfied with her creation, she sat down on top of the little stack and wiggled her wings and belly to shape it into a respectable little habitat. Next, she inspected her creation from all sides and flew away to bring soft chicken feathers and crushed dry leaves to pad the inside. Now there are three chicks in the nest, waiting with open mouths for her to feed them. While painting, I don't think about what the work says. A painting of mine is not a statement. Rather, it is a droplet in an infinite stream of artworks, some of which I will make, while others will remain part of an imaginary necklace. Around me are two or three, sometimes six or seven, paintings in different stages of completion, each with its own rhythm, each an adventurous journey of arranging, splattering, and gathering. Splattering came along as a way of reducing the tedious layering of oil glazes, not as automatic gestures like the Surrealists, more like a Pollock-style attack on the canvas. It is the most physical aspect in the process of painting. It is an invigorating gymnastic. I wave a brush dripping with oil paint in the air and find the rhythm hidden in the canvas. I need to control the image. However, splattering is the stage in which I let go, the wild phase between the structural and the considered. Next, I'd work to bring together the scattered marks from discord to accord to find hints of the original structure and with measured brushstrokes will it into completion. It is my first drought on the land. Never before have I felt the burden of the possibility of no water. Over the last year, we have watched the water in our river dwindle. Every month, we discovered a new waterline engraved on the creek's walls and found that the exposed Caserina's roots had changed colour and texture. I take the Nikon and record pink, black and lime green stripes on the edge of the bank and on exposed rocks. I enjoy the aesthetics, but I watch the watercress on the water's surface in horror Like a beast of prey on its hunt, the weeds await to overtake the next patch of clear water. I walk to the studio, observing the young trees that define the boundaries of the estate. Growing up in Israel, one's dreams were confined to a quarter acre. In Australia, 5 acres does not a farm make, but in my vocabulary, it's an estate. And today, the estate's fields are green. Just a couple of weeks ago, there were shades of yellow and brown. Dust was everywhere. The dark soil was cracked. The tree's tenacity amazes me. Winter of heavy frosts, spring of scorching temperatures. Summer of blazing heat. Underlining the change of seasons is the longest drought on record. Yet, we lost only a few young native trees. Tolerance and patience, a lesson to be learned from indigenous species. Dusk leisurely takes over the last rays of sunshine. In the rabbit-proof vegetable garden, I look in despair at small patches of thirsty ground between the gigantic zucchinis and the sprawling tomato bushes. A month ago, I could still read my aspirations in the veggie patch. Now I collect both successes and disappointments in the wreck. A month ago, a weed-free garden, the only delight in a drought. Today, some weeds are taller than the chili plants. From where I stand, the yellow cottage seems to have developed a shimmering pink aura around it, as if overnight the bottle brushes, the grevilleas and the butterfly shrubs have teamed up to display their delicate flowers in arrays of pinks and red. Slowly, everything we have planted is making itself at home, and we reap the benefits. The pleasures are such that now I don't need to count them. Chet Baker's husky voice penetrates the night. He sings, "I mortgage my castles in the air." The line resonates with shattered hopes. I like the wording. I collect sentences. I write them down on scraps of paper, on empty pages in books, in my blank black books, on the back of bookmarks. It's like taking photographs. While looking through the lens and framing the scene, the image registers somewhere, stored, till, unconsciously, I find a use for it. From time to time, on cold winter nights or very hot afternoons, I go through my photographs and recognize how many of them had served unwittingly as reference for my artworks. In contrast, the sentences I collect stay chaotic on shelves and in drawers. Perhaps they are unwittingly incorporated in the things I write or say. I'm ready to attack the canvases, but have a change of feeling while staring at the blank surfaces. It feels as if I'm keeping the images at a distance from myself. Last night, I dreamed of a painting, a very large white canvas with a beautifully rendered small figure in the upper left corner. I cling to the feeling it gave me. Sometimes in my dreams, I paint paintings that are just perfect. Yet in the studio, I cannot replicate the quality or the atmosphere. I'm never sure if those images were so good because they just were, or because they were never created. I enjoy painting nude women. I take pleasure in discovering how to relate body to soil. For hours I watch the canvas on which the paint has no reason. The marks I made the day before make no sense. Gradually, without much effort, shapes and textures reveal themselves. I mix lots of different colours into grey. I love creating greys with just a nuance of pink, yellow or purple, which set up vibrations. Any surface devoid of colour, as it may be, teems with activity of colliding colours. A woman painting the female nude is nothing like a man painting the female nude. For both, it's an exploration of an organic, sensual form. However, for men, painting the female body is an expression of desire, lust, and a wish to possess. For a woman, it is a celebration of self. But why paint the nude in the 21st century? To capture the way the skin reflects light? To render the way form molds light? I resist the urge to look for interpretation. I don't mind describing the process or how it feels to make the art work. But that is very different from telling what the work is about. As a maker, I cannot view the work from the outside, but I can, upon completion, enter into an exchange of ideas with an audience, hoping to understand the nature of the relationship between the viewer and the artwork. The locals reckon you become one of them after at least 15 years in the area. I believe you become a local when you stop being amazed by what you see when you step outdoors. Late one evening last week, I was introduced to the great orb-weaving spider. The web, luminous in the moonlight, hovered 2 meters above the path to the studio. It stretched between the wattle and a young gum tree about 6 meters apart. A large spider in the centre of a delicate orb waited for her victim. Did she make a giant leap? Apparently, she hooks her thread to one treetop, walks down and over to the other tree, climbs up to the next treetop, and stretches the thread between the two trees. The suspended thin line turns into the foundation of the web. Next she walks over to the middle and starts weaving delicate threads into an intricate design. In the morning, she's gone. Unlike other spiders that can usually be seen pottering around repairing their web, she starts all over again every evening. Last night on the way back from the studio, I got tangled in her web. Sticky threads all over me. Then I felt a movement in my hair. On the fridge, we hung a spider chart. The blurb says that the orb-weaving spider is relatively harmless and quite beneficial, and so is the huntsman. But lots of things can happen to your heart when a great orb is crawling in your hair, or a large huntsman hiding behind the sunshade in the car drops onto your lap while driving. Only traces of summer are left to be registered. It's the last week of summer, yet the heat shows no indication of letting go. Again and again, when the heat is unbearable, I find myself longing for words. There are times when I hold on to words like a woman drowning, hoping that the rumbling of words will pave a path back to the easel. Other times I believe that the repetitive movements of the brush will sort out my precarious state. During those times, when I'm not sure how to put one foot in front of the other, I believe that somehow I'll paint my way into being an inspired person. Body and Soil. A good working title. Yet the work is not coming together. I hesitate over marked landscapes, stumble on female bodies. I hum and haw about 2 distinct themes, hoping them to merge. All of a sudden, cumulus clouds covered the sun and opened, drenching everything. Sitting under the willow, I couldn't see the changing light or the gathering clouds. It was the sound of the rain that I heard first. The sound of large drops hitting leaves, stones and water. My tranquil spot in the river was transformed in a matter of seconds into a cacophony of smells, sounds and wild patterns. Calmness returned as suddenly as it had been interrupted. Where I was sitting, drops kept sliding off the leaves, slower and slower, changing the music and the ripples they make. On the way back home, I looked at the patterns the large drops painted on the dry stones. Which is the true colour of stone? Saturated with rain or bleached by sun? Autumn. A few weeks ago, it seemed unbelievable that the leaves should be changing their colour or that frosts will cover the morning landscape. Now, the Chinese tallow has turned shades of russet, and the golden elm, true to its name, has turned golden yellow. Daylight is retracting. In the mornings, the dew stays longer, the wind is cooler, and the chickens go to roost earlier every day. In contrast to city life, here it is not the drop of temperature that marks the end of summer. Rather, it is the sound of chainsaw preparing firewood, and the beat of an axe splitting it. This is the sound we heard last autumn, and it's here again. To the north, we are separated from the road by regular ironbark posts bound together with wire. The fence serves only as a visual barrier between the dirt road and us. To the west, we are separated from the horse stud by three efficient fences. To the east with two, ours and the neighbour's electric fencing. The fences reflect the way landholders use the land to mark private property and to control animals. In my mind, I paint a fence interrupting an image of trees reflected in water. I sketch several possibilities. I think of reflections as interrupted images, and of the water not only as the surface, which mirrors a world, but also as a layer separating two worlds. I let go of the fence. It's too literal, trees and timber. And I must confess, painting a fence is aesthetically uninteresting. When I woke up, it was mid-morning. Usually I know the time of day from the quality of the light, but this morning, the fog, like a silk scarf the colour of crushed pearls, seems to have penetrated my head. I felt in need of inspiration. I thought about deserts. The first time I went to the desert, I was surprised by the lack of sweeping sand dunes. The parched desert that surrounds the Dead Sea is more like fossilized sand ridges and mounds. They form a maze of ravines and valleys that frame the basin of the Salty Lake. An awesome place where only a scorpion can hear you sing, and only an eagle's cry might disturb the silence. The first time I went to the Australian desert, I was surprised by the lushness of the country. But it was neither the unusual flora nor the exotic fauna, neither the dramatic colours of rugged cliffs nor the texture of scrublands that seized me. It was the quality of the light. It washed over stones baking for eons in the unrelenting sun. It squeezed into nooks and crannies, swept shadows and distorted perspective. It altered space and transformed time. Stones the shades of reds, yellows, whites and purples carried primordial memories. It was as if I had walked into my own paintings and ambled among the pigments. All radiated solace, as if the arid country opened up to embrace me. I have discovered the joys of circling the paddock on a ride-on mower. I climb onto the rover, adjust the level of the blade, and off I go. The grass is usually home to a plethora of insects. Spiders, grasshoppers, crickets, stick insects, moths, butterflies, and others which I could not name to save my life. As the ride-on advances, I watch weeds, grass, cave in, and an army of panicked creatures running for their lives. They hop, jump, creep, crawl, and fly to find shelter in the uncut grass. The setting sun caught the tips of the grass, and the circles turned to bronze. From a distance they looked like metal puddles in an expanse of lime-green moss, or perhaps they looked like bronze buttons on a velvet garment. By the time I could get the camera, the sun had withdrawn her generosity, leaving the paddock the colour of ash. A perfect backdrop for the two red-winged blue parrots that were still munching and chuckling along the edge of the cut grass. Observing the sad aftermath of my ephemeral installation of grass and light, I reflect, must a work of art be witnessed or shared to be considered as such? Is the intention to make a work of art crucial to its being one? All that grass inspired two new paintings, another duo in the series of concave, convex, a disintegrating nest floating on calm water, and a pool of agitated water nested amidst tall, disturbed spinifex. I find the idea of concave, convex intriguing. The very same line that creates concave automatically creates convex, two opposites, each existing by virtue of the other. At times, I am tempted to use actual, natural objects as material for my artwork. I could dig out a section of the paddock. I could paint the trunk of a young tree bright pink and record its growth. I could plant trees and make them grow in unnatural ways. I could shape nature according to my wildest imagination. Somehow it feels wrong to torture nature. This morning I noticed that I was going for a swim. It sounds like a strange thing to notice, since I do it almost every day without noticing it. Usually my mind is already in the pool counting laps or contemplating unfinished paintings. What I was really noticing this morning was the repetitions. Having lived in several different places, I often wonder what it would be like to live your own life in just one place. It would mean, among other things, a degree of repetition I can hardly imagine, and with it an awareness of subtle changes. Since we have moved to the valley, I marveled many times at where we are and how we live. Many times when I walk to the studio, I feel as if I'm hovering beside myself. Everything is both familiar and mystifying at the same time. Are people who live in the same place all their lives able to see themselves from a bird's point of view? While I was debating whether to head toward the studio or the river, the quality of the light convinced me to proceed to the former. If only I could capture the glow that engulfed the valley. The sun had just moved behind the dark clouds that were threatening all afternoon. The sight was dramatic, but the light was soft, somehow diluted by the cool air. It washed the valley with a brief, uninhibited glow. On one easel a painting of tracks, on another a nude. Which painting should receive the yellow-pink light? Both paintings refused to accept the light. When I paint, I follow a course which I trace roughly at the start of the work. I follow this course carefully, watching for new terrains. These new places are what make the process interesting. There are times when I explore a new territory, I might lose the path. I get carried away by texture, details, or both, and I don't notice that what I did makes the work weak. When I discover that I went too far in the wrong direction, that I must go back to the fork in the road, that I must cover my tracks, I need nerve. I need to be brave and destroy sections of the painting that by themselves might be great achievements. I look at the tracks I actually paint. They become a metaphor for the tracks I follow in the process of painting. I let the painting ask the question and hope that it will refuse inappropriate answers. I proceed slowly, not to miss a new angle. Carefully I layer paint, as if not to cause its demise. I don't want to cover my tracks. I want to see through the luminous opacity, which is the surface of the canvas. This way of working is more considered. There is humility to it. The painting of tracks has refused to be submerged in water. This morning I entered the studio with determination to reclaim my authority over it. Yalla! I shouted with a brush in my hand. Many hours later, having limited my horizon to the large rectangle of the canvas, I stepped back and saw that it was good. But the painting is far from being tamed. This inanimate object, made out of stretched linen and paint, is unquestionably in charge. But because what replaced my original idea was quite exciting, I decided to follow what was emerging. My artwork is essentially an outpouring of uncertainties, a dialogue between the probable and the improbable. Today the valley looks as if it has been granted an extra dimension. The landscape seems to have been extended. The overabundance of late summer greens, which at times reduces the valley to two dimensions, has given way to a profusion of bright, earthy colours. Against the evergreen eucalyptuses, the grevilleas and wattles, those colours gave the landscape an added width. In spring and summer, the trees give solidity and weight to the landscape. These days, they create a delicate pattern of glittering foliage and wooden veins, giving the landscape a fragile quality, an unbearable lightness. Winter. The rhythmic sound of a cargo train on its way north or south echoes from the ridges. I like the silence that follows the last freight carriage. In a drought, the silence is loud. Birds and insects take their song to greener pastures. Drought in the winter is louder. Diluted light and thinner air render the day naked. I walk the estate listing transformations. In the orchard, under each fruit tree, there is a ring of fallen leaves. Golden for the apricots, rust for the pears, yellowish-brown for the rest. Next to the fence, rows of naked, graceless pomegranate bushes seem to be emerging out of shimmering gold puddles. Working from a studio situated in the middle of a paddock, I reflect on my wandering. I trace journeys made over decades on other continents in different cultures and languages. I try to find links, to find metaphoric expressions which will bridge personal and geographical landscape. Physical and human mobility have provided context for my artwork. Moving around the world is part of my heritage. As I look back at my family history, I see a tension between memories and experiences. When one needs to, or is forced to move, this is the time when fantasies struggle with what is tangible. Images take shape in our minds and we search for them in the new place we call home. These images don't always correspond to reality. So being on the move inspires, among other things, a dialogue between rest and restlessness, between alienation and attachment, between fiction and truth. In addition, displacement causes landscape to change, and this in turn may trigger in some people an urge to contemplate the relevance of place. I wish to make paintings that will mirror such thoughts. In winter, the light is forever changing, lingering frosted dawns pursued by short intervals of sunshine, which are brutally interrupted by stretched-out dusks. In winter, the sun skirts about the day, like an unwanted refugee tracing the periphery of a promised land. There's no better place to watch the sun being chased away by the approaching darkness as on top of a burning mountain. After a climb through a typical Australian bush, a change. Dozens of dead trees lie, roots exposed where they fell not so long ago. The forest floor is barren. Only gum trees grow in this earth, baked by an underground burning seam of coal. Undernourished, they gave in to the power of gravity. Shadows blend. The pale light that penetrates the thin canopies above creates an atmosphere of doom. I think about the images of trees I painted in which I undertook to liberate the image from gravity. About the images of shadows cast upon barren landscape, which enables me to introduce an action which was taking place outside the canvas. The overall hue of the scenery I look at is the colour of ashen brown, and along the trail are patches of burnt earth turned ochre, rust, yellow and white. The very same colours I used to create those images years ago. By late afternoon we'd reached the white, smouldering summit. From where I'd stand the view was of rolling green hills extending east, south, west and north, into the horizon which tints them blue. Scores of kangaroos watch me in bewilderment. The white ash is dotted by their black droppings. The ground on which I stand looks like the surface of Mars. Deep cracks in the rock emit hot air which smells odiously of sulphur. I consider myself lucky that this geological wonder exists just within the stone's throw away from where I live. When I enter the studio, the smell of turpentine hits me. I love it. It reminds me I exist. The lingering odour means I continue to exist even in absence. Next, I open the door of the combustion stove, poke the black log, and am amazed to find a burning fire within its charred embers. There is something reassuring about a flame waiting to be released. The paintings around me have a subject matter. but they are neither stories nor allegories, they just are. They carry meanings which I cannot read. I know they do because they seem right. Women's naked bodies stare at me. I don't paint faces, yet I can feel their gaze. They radiate familiarity. They are real. I prefer to think of the art I make as a series of urges rather than realizations of ideas. Last night I had a nightmare. In my dream, I covered the 10 meters panel that makes the playground with white gesso. When I finished, happy to have a new surface on which to paint, I realized the painting was scheduled to be exhibited. When my father died, I dedicated to him a 10 meters commission, the playground, an urban detail. A place in which children play and imagine. A place where dreams and fears create patterns and leave their marks. Up to several years ago, I had always lived in cities, major cities like New York, Vienna, and Sydney. When I was a little girl in Tel Aviv, we played hopscotch on paved footpaths and built castles in cemented sandboxes. Life in the city was living among jarring opposites and complex tensions. What made city life exciting was constantly juggling beauty and ugliness, intelligence and ignorance, order and chaos, and nevertheless staying sane. In the playground, I set out to examine this mixture of forces through the games children play. It was an opportunity to bring Father to the studio, to a world he was unable to make his own. It was my way of acknowledging the seeds he had planted in the child he took to see the meager collections in Tel Aviv's museums and galleries. It was a tribute to his cultured spirit that had surfaced despite deprived circumstances. Some of the words I write attempt to connect between the metamorphosis of the imagination and that of nature. When I write, I can go in different directions and open up vistas I only dream of when I paint. When I direct the brush inward, downward, or outward, I am always at the risk of losing the plot. When I write, it's not a plot. What interests me are the very things a plot would sideline. When making images, metaphors are my main resource. When writing, I call on metaphors last, to make the portrayal precise. Somewhere I read that metaphors are a way to help our mind process the unprocessable. I've noticed that metaphors are useless when it comes to talking about silence and absence. The afternoon air is crisp. A patch of gathered leaves, trapped by the wind, is whirling just above the ground. The dogs are hypnotized. The wind lets go of leaves in the margins, and they tumble down in a slow motion. Mishka tries to grab a moving leaf and disturbs the arrangement. I think of butterflies. The turquoise butterflies that come with spring, and the colourless ones that flap in anxious stomachs. Leslie walked over. His beaming face held a promise of delight. He took hold of my hand and gently directed me to the back of the studio. The sky was grey, the light was grey, the air was cool. The feeling of his hand in mine was warm. We reached the back fence, where hidden among the wild fennel was a large echidna. We stood there looking at the confused creature. I could hear the song of birds, the rustle of leaves and swaying of branches in the gathering wind. I could hear the faint sound of the distant highway. I think of Thoreau, and how he rejoiced in the sounds he would hear in Walden. He wrote, "I love a broad margin to my life." Perhaps, I think, my life consists only of broad margins. Spring. The arrival of spring is in fact a non-event. It happens every year at the same time and in the same way. Yet it is always sudden and exciting. Everything seems to have acquired a complexion of optimism. It is a season of now you see it, now you don't, as well as now you don't see it, now you do. Overnight, grass and clover have regained their dominance over the frost-bitten brown paddock. While I blink, the wooden veins of bare trees acquire a green blush. A snake is out, and then it disappears in a flash in the thicket next to the river. Birds materialize out of trees and vanish as mysteriously as they appear. New clusters of daffodils emerged under the tortured willow where the earth was covered with decomposing leaves. The Hebrew name for daffodil is Narcissus, derived from Narcissus. The myth of Narcissus is about ambiguity. The relationship between the object and its reflection is uncertain. Narcissus contemplates his own reflection, but does not know his own image. I painted a reclining woman reflected in water, but it felt not quite right. I covered the reflection. I did not like the clear relationship between the body and its reflected image. I would like the water to become a boundary between worlds rather than a surface that mirrors sameness. I name the painting I'm currently working on The Memory of Water. The canvas is divided into three, but none of the parts are solved. I find water difficult to paint. I must change attitude. I need new tricks. To be able to paint water is to think about colour rather than about form or texture. Usually when painting, I consider the source of light and its effects. Now I need to think in terms of fragmented colours and broken patterns. Down at the river, the water tickles my ankles. I wish to outline a square of shimmering little ovals on the moving surface, to wrap it with my shirt, to hide it in my pocket, and in the studio I'd place it in a closed jar on a green shelf in the cabinet where I put other things I've collected. The Memory of Water is almost finished. I find myself hypnotized by the painting. I think it is very beautiful. I worry that beautiful is just pretty. Is there a place for the just beautiful in the contemporary world of art? Modern European artists wish to destroy the beauty formulated by the Greeks and expressed by the Renaissance artists. The Impressionists and later the Cubists got caught in the problem of what is beautiful, and instead of doing away with the ancient values, they ended up merely shifting them. In the 40s, American artists denied that art has anything to do with beauty and argued that they were making art that was devoid of any association with the beautiful. And finally, postmodern artists argued that they redirected the tradition of the beautiful. In the world of art, theories are coming and going. Ideas about the beautiful have been in a state of flux for over a century. Yet the beautiful, as ephemeral as she is, lingers on, perhaps bemused by attempts to destroy, negate, or ignore her. I made small black and white sketches for The Way of Water, a 6-meter quartet portraying three worlds, underwater, surface, and reflection. I ordered the four panels and made mental lists of waterscapes I should observe next week on my visit to Mutwinji. I was already there. I smelt decomposing dry gum leaves seeping from between cracks in the large boulders. I touched hot, crumbling sandstones on the way for a swim in a rock pool. By the time I'd get back, the canvases should be ready. It's 4 a.m. The torch cuts a bright circle in the moonless night. The indigo dome above me is dotted with bright, sparkling stars. When I first opened my eyes in this ungodly hour to the sound of an angry wind, I looked up and wondered whether the display of galaxies existed just to add splendor to the night sky. I lay in a swag, surrounded by an awesome display of cliffs. The huge rocks are more ancient than I could imagine, but their stillness is deceptive. Even as I ponder their antiquity, they're in motion, changing themselves and their surrounding. The gorges have been shaped by wind, rain, and sun. The weather has turned large rocks into smaller stones and pebbles into pebbles dust. The outer surface has become sand grains which are blown around, colliding into each other and land on the ground. And the wind I hear is making more sand, which in time will turn into sandstone. I woke up early to see sunrise above the silhouetted ranges. The moon was like a silver opening in the great arc of the indigo sky. I tried to hold onto the nightscape before the sun would disperse the ambiguity of colours. I crawled out of the swag, found my boots, and set off to climb the nearby range. The golden orb to the east was emerging slowly, covering the landscape, soft pinks. I liked the idea that where I stood, only birds and crawling insects could see me. By now, the sun has regained its high place in the sky, and the soil has lost the untarnished quality it had acquired during the winter under a blanket of mulch. This is the time when I'd mapped the vegetable patch. This is the time when the plan is perfect, if only in my imagination. Not this spring. I have shut myself in a studio with 6 meters of primed linen, and with a set of brushes in my hand, I conduct the 4 panels. An almost impossible deadline means that I cannot let the painting take over. I make sure that at all stages I am in control. Usually I will let a painting get away, so that it takes me to places I cannot envision. Not this time. Many phases are still tentative, yet I don't have time for failures. My body is tense. I'm working against the grain. Too bad, but I cannot let it mature naturally. I must manage its growth. And since I don't follow a prearranged mental picture, a vision to which I must adhere, every move is like walking on thin ice. Every brushstroke is a response to another brushstroke. Every mark leads to another mark. The structural stages are hardly visible. I've also lost some parts which I was particularly attached to, and I cannot yet see the final phase. There are many things I want to record in words, large issues, big changes, profound thoughts. But when I finally hit the keyboard, I don't feel like writing about brushstrokes loaded with self-doubt, the lack of common sense in an otherwise wonderful world, or my thoughts on the latest book I've read. Instead, I wish to write about subtle shifts of everyday life, about cool November mornings filled with the scent of honeysuckle, about the taste of freshly picked strawberries, about large pink cacti flowers, about hundreds of little red wrens and the racket they make at dawn next to the bedroom window. In the paddock, we have 3 large planters which Leslie cut out of an old 10,000-gallon water tank. They became containers for primary colours. In the yellow planter, I planted daffodils, poppies, calla lilies, Jerusalem sage, Spanish broom, Japanese rose, a grevillea, and a dwarf wattle. In the red planter, poppies, Jacobean irises, lilies, gladiolus, dahlias, a tea tree, a grevillea, and a dwarf bottlebrush. In the blue planter, love in the mist, Dutch irises, Russian sage, lavenders, salvias, and a wisteria. According to Alexander Thoreau, blue is the rarest colour in nature. Yellow is linked to the sun, and red is the most popular colour of all. In my list of primary colours, blue is the colour I use to create space, the colour of the sky and the abyss, shadows and royalty, the colour of school uniform and distant mountains. It is the colour of the numbers tattooed on the arms of the Holocaust survivors, the colour of ash, and the tongue of the lizard. Deep water and melancholia. There is blue cheese, blue movies, and blue Arabs who roam parts of the Sahara. Yellow is the colour I use to paint light, of starving lawn and of shrubs lacking in iron. Yellow is also for illumination, wisdom, lemon and butter. Tara's tennis balls, and the cloth star Jews had to place on their sleeves. The colour of our cottage and Indian curry, gold and hay, jealousy and healing. Then there is yellow fever, yellow river, yellow sea, and yellow submarine. yellow pages and yellow press. Red is the colour I paint the blank canvas with, the ground from which the image emerges. It's a colour of blood and tomatoes, of love and death, of strawberries and Chinese lanterns, stop signs and Catholic ceremonial dress. Exciting, aggressive, and the colour of girls' first shoes, the colour of fire and Matisse's studio, iron and the rock and menstruation. And then there are red backs, red lines and red lights, the red army, the red brigades, the red guards and red wrens. The ways of water is completed. For over 2 months my world was confined to 4 large rectangles, with hardly any reflection or examination. With apprehension I looked forward to seeing if the panels worked together and complied with my original intentions. Leslie stretched a steel wire across the studio between the ironbark posts and hanged the painting like clean clothes out of the washing machine. I held my breath. What I saw rendered my earlier trepidations irrelevant. Yet it remained in the atmosphere. So I asked Leslie how he felt about the painting we had just hung. He looked at me bemused and said he did not understand my doubts. Summer is almost here. These days the sun sets slowly, as if wishing to postpone its appointment with the horizon. The light disappears gradually. Unlike in winter days, in summer, it's easy to see when day finishes and night begins. The vanishing light sucks the colours out of the valley. We are submerged in silence, as if everything stops in anticipation of the coming night, wishing not to disturb the cosmic motion. Only when night comes and the stars appear can we sense the landscape breathing a sigh of relief. The night air smelled of November. How does November smell? It's the smell of the arrival of summer in Australia. It's the smell of snow in New York. It's the smell of wet winter in Tel Aviv. The sense of smell is a strange kind of seeing. It conjures up sentimental landscapes. The smell of cut grass equals making hay on a kibbutz in the Israel Valley. The smell of newly stretched linen equals southern slopes of Mount Carmel. The smell of oil paint equals apple strudel in Vienna's inner city. The smell of moist earth and rotting organic particles equals picking cyclamens among rotting pine needles on the ground of the Jerusalem forests. The smell of the seashells equals sandcastles on the beach. The smell of morning filled with the scent of honeysuckle, the smell of crushed dried eucalyptus leaves, the smell of dust in hot air. I never had an answer to the question, how do you know a painting is finished? Now I know. An artwork is finished when I don't want to let go of it, when I know in my body that it is finished, yet I don't want to stop working on it.